the final week of when before Jesus is going to be crucified. I fall into the trap of saying it's the final week that Jesus is going to be on earth, but we know, and we will study in the future, that Jesus spends some time on earth after he is resurrected. So it's not his final days on earth, but it is the last few days that we're going to be talking about for the next couple of weeks, the last few days before he is crucified. We talked about the fact that the beginning of this last week, basically, or at the very end of the previous week, Jesus went and traveled from Jericho down to Jerusalem. And we talked about the fact that, you know, it was a significant physical journey for him to take. But it was he needs to be in Jerusalem at this time, and he knows that. We talked about the fact that he had a dinner at the home of Simon the leper, and we talked about some events that happened there, and who was in attendance, including Lazarus, and who Jesus had raised from the dead and was now sitting there eating dinner with him, and Martha and Mary, and the fact that Mary anointed Jesus with some very expensive oil, and that caused a little bit of a riff with Judas and some others that he had kind of incited to get excited about it. And it was very expensive oil, but we do know that from what's been recorded in the scriptures that Judas wasn't so upset that the oil wasn't being used to feed the poor like he tried to say, but the fact that he couldn't get his hands on the money. But Jesus rebukes Judas and the others who are questioning that and commends Mary, even to the point where he says what she's done will be talked about as long as the gospel is preached. What this woman has done will be taught and talked about. So then the following day, which is actually is Sunday, first day of the week, Sunday of Jesus' last week, Jesus actually enters Jerusalem. We call it the triumphal entry. The common people there are very excited to see him. They are shouting praises to him. Basically, the praises saying, you know, glory to God for salvation. Salvation has been brought to the back to the throne of David. And we talked about the fact that, for the most part, they were probably thinking that, not still on the terms of physical kingdom being restored, but didn't fully understand, but they were still praising Jesus, praising God as Jesus enters Jerusalem. But we also know that there were Pharisees there that were not thrilled about it. They were upset because they had been working, putting their efforts over the last couple of years into stopping Jesus, and they basically, in talking amongst themselves, say everything we've done has been useless. We've accomplished nothing. The whole world's still chasing after this man. So the Pharisees are not excited about what's going on. The people are shouting all these praises. The Pharisees tell Jesus, you need to make these people be quiet. And Jesus, very in their face, tells them, there's nothing you can do to stop this. If I were to tell these people to stop crying out, the stones would cry out. Basically, what I was telling them, you don't grasp what's going on here. There is nothing you can do to stop what's happening right now. This is going to happen. Of course, Jesus knows what's going to be happening in just a few days. They want that to happen. That's what all their efforts are towards. We're even told that not only do they want to kill Jesus, but they're after Lazarus as well, just because the events around Lazarus have caused people to believe in him. So we are now getting into and what we're going to talk about today. And I also want to bring out the fact that we talked about at the end of that, all that first day of as Jesus is retiring back out of the city for the evening, that Jesus stops and looks back over Jerusalem and weeps. We talked about the fact that Jesus is God, and Jesus was there at the beginning. He was at the beginning when everything was created. He was at the beginning when sin entered the earth, and they already had a plan for what was going to have to happen. Jesus was there when the promises were made to Abraham. Jesus was part of that promise being delivered to Abraham. And so Jesus is there to accomplish that final piece of the promise, what we call the seed promise. But the land and the nation promise had already been fulfilled, and they were fulfilled in the people that Jesus was right there with. That's the nation part of it and the land part of it. And Jerusalem is the holy city for all of that, for the people of Israel under that covenant. And Jesus looks back on that city and is distraught. And basically he's saying, if you would have just accepted God, how different things could be, right? And that's basically what he's saying in his lamenting over Jerusalem. So, and Jesus knows that in a very short time, not necessarily in terms of we think of time, but in a very short time overall, the whole city is going to be destroyed, right? This incredible city that was built, supposed to be in the holy city where God is worshipped by his special people, and it's going to be destroyed. And all because, not because God failed in anything, but because they just would not allow God to do what he wanted to do with them. If you remember, the promises that were made when they entered the land, the promises that were made to them were all conditional, right? That I am going to bless you in ways that you can't, as we discussed last week, in my opinion, if you look at everything, other than the fact that sin has entered the world and there's nothing's going to take away death and everything else that came with that. But everything else, God was almost putting them back in the Garden of Eden. They were not going to suffer from diseases. No woman was going to be barren. None of their cattle or sheep or anything else were going to be barren. Everything was going to be productive. Everything they put their hands to was going to be productive. Today, I can go out and I can get some orange tree seeds and I can plant 10 of them and 5 of them might germinate, 3 of them might germinate, 8 of them. And any of the ones that germinate might grow up to be full-grown trees but never produce an orange for whatever reason. They could get frozen. God was promised that's never going to happen. If you plant an orange tree, you're going to get oranges from it, right? As long as you follow me. But he also made it very clear to them that if you don't follow me, exactly what was going to happen, right? So none of this was God's fault. God told them exactly what he was preparing to do for them if they would follow him and exactly what was going to happen if they didn't. And so Jesus is lamenting over this whole thing of God did everything he did could for his part, as far as all that land and nation promise, but they didn't do their part. But God is going to follow through with the rest of that promise here very shortly in the fact that all nations are going to be blessed through the sacrifice that Jesus makes. So we are now, as we get into our study today, we're going to be basically on Monday. Jesus is going to be put to death on Friday. So the events we're going to be talking about today are going to occur on Monday of that week. But before we get started on that, Jerry's going to lead us in a word of prayer. Amen. Okay, so Jesus, he's just been through the day of the triumphal entry, and each evening he doesn't stay in Jerusalem. Each evening he returns back to Bethany and stays there overnight, and then the next day he'll go back into Jerusalem, and that's what's happening now. So I'm going to read Mark 11, 12 through 14. So Mark 11, 12 through 14. It says, now the next day, when they had come out of Bethany, he was hungry. And seeing afar a fig tree having leaves, he went to see if perhaps he would find something on it. When he came to it, he found nothing but leaves, for it was not the season for figs. In response, Jesus said to it, let no one eat fruit from you ever again. And his disciples heard it. Now I'm going to turn over and read Matthew's account. Matthew 21, verses 18 and 19. And I'm not going to read all of verse 19 because we're going to get into that next week. But starting in verse 18, find where I'm at here. Now in the morning, as he returned to the city, he was hungry, and seeing a fig tree by the road, he came to it and found nothing on it but leaves, and said to it, let no fruit grow on you ever again. Okay, so Jesus returned to Bethany. Morning comes, he gets up. They're going to travel back into Jerusalem where he can continue teaching and doing what he needs to do in Jerusalem. But he gets up. They're traveling back into Jerusalem, and Jesus is hungry, and he sees a fig tree. And he goes over to the fig tree, and he finds no figs on it to eat. And he curses the fig tree. Now, just a couple of things to bring up before we get into a little more discussion on it. It clearly says it was not the season for figs, right? However, when I lived in Italy as a very small child, we had fig trees in the backyard. My mom would pick them and make all kind of stuff out of them. But figs typically put on the new green figs before the leaves come on to the trees. So even though it was not the season for figs to be ripe, if the tree had leaves on it, it should have had at least the small green figs on it. We don't know for sure whether it did or not. It says Jesus didn't find any figs to eat. Now, there could have possibly been, I guess, some small figs on there, but I have no idea. We're not really told. All we know is that there were no figs there that Jesus could eat, and Jesus curses the tree. So, question. Does this event kind of seem a little bit out of character for Jesus? I'm not saying sinful. I'm not saying that he did anything wrong, but does it seem a little bit out of character? I mean, that Jesus would go down to this fig tree in a time when it's not normal for figs to be on trees and find no figs there that he could eat, and he curses the tree and says, nobody's ever going to eat from you again.
Shows the stress that he was under.
That's one possibility. There's two different possibilities, and most of what I could read on it, people seem to agree with this, but that doesn't mean that there's not another possibility, and I tend to go towards what was just brought up, the fact that Jesus is hungry, Jesus is completely stressed out, Jesus knows what he's about to go through, right? He is, I don't know if we can properly take enough time to realize the incredible emotional stress Jesus is under right now. We always concentrate, and I'm not saying it's wrong to concentrate on the physical abuse that Jesus puts up with in this week. I'm not saying that's wrong at all. It's there for us. We need to see that. We need to concentrate that on that. But I think just as much, if not maybe even more of a stress on Jesus is what he's going through emotionally. We see that he just stopped and cried over Jerusalem, right? And here it is the next morning, he's getting up to go back into Jerusalem. You know, he didn't just sit there, look at Jerusalem, cry, you know, basically, you know, say what he did about Jerusalem. We want to just go to sleep and forget about it. It was probably on his mind the whole night, just how things have come about. How no matter how hard God tried to bless these people, they just wouldn't accept him. They wouldn't do what God asked him to do. So all that's on his mind. He is stressed out. He comes to this fig tree. So there's two possibilities. One, there's no little green figs on it, even though there's there's leaves on it. And a lot of what I read, most people seem to point toward that, so that the tree is truly a barren tree. And then the other possibility is that this is part of the stress that's on Jesus, that he is just, you know, gets a little frustrated. But again, not in a sinful way, not that he did anything wrong or anything else, just maybe kind of an indication of where he's at mentally and emotionally. I'm not going to get into, because we're going to get into it next week, where we actually talk about the fact that the tree withers up and the disciples are perplexed over the whole thing. But when we do get into that, and I'm not going to jump too far ahead, but Jesus never gives us a reason as to why he did it. He tells them in response, you'll be able to do similar things, right? And there's obviously a teaching moment here, and we're not, if he sat down and taught them anything around this, it's not recorded for us. But obviously, many times Jesus has pointed out the fact that if you don't bear fruit, you get taken away, right? We have the vine and the branches. We have many other things that fits right in with Jesus' teaching, and that may be primarily what he was doing here. And there may have been some discussion that's not recorded for us about this, but you know, it is possible, and I keep going back to that because I want, as we go through these next few weeks of this talking about this final week right up to his crucifixion, for us to not lose sight of just what Jesus had to be going through, not just physically, but emotionally, because I think that's important for us to do that, for us to really get a true understanding of what Christ did for us. I mean, literally, the moment that he left heaven, from that moment forward, he has been sacrificed. Every breath he took was a sacrifice for us. He left heaven and had to come down and live on this earth as you know, not a rich person that everybody ran to and said, oh, look, Jesus is in the room. From the day, basically, he was born till the time that he died, somebody was after him, right? So we want to try to remember, as we go through this final week, to try as often as we can to, best as we can, understand what Jesus had to be going through. Because he was human just like we were. So everything that would affect you affected him. Every temptation that would come upon you came upon him. Now, we don't deal with them well like he did. But I mean, just going through all the different events of throughout his whole life, but especially his final week, over and over again, I can find places where I know I would have failed there. You know, as we get into more him being on the cross and the way that he was treated in his trial and everything else, there's no way that I could have remained silent. I would have had to jump out there and say, you know, do you even realize what you're saying? You know, you're obviously completely dumb or completely ignorant, because what you're saying, you know, there's many times like that when they were mocking him on the cross, saying, you know, if you're really this, come down and help you. It would have been hard for me not to say, you know what, you're right. I'm about to show you exactly what could happen, right? But Jesus didn't. But just let's remember to try to, as we study these things, to try to get as best we can, get a grasp on what Jesus had to be going through, because he was human. So it is possible that he cursed the tree because it's barren, that there was no figs on it whatsoever, and he just cursed the tree because it's barren. But would he have had to do that? If the tree was barren, nobody was going to eat from it again no matter what, right? So, but it could have been a teachable moment where, like we said many times, he talks about the fact that if we don't bear fruit, you get pruned away, just like anything else. So could have been just that simple, or it could just be there. The main purpose that it's there recorded for us is just to see that it's a little bit out of character for Jesus to react this way. Not that he did anything wrong, anything sinful, anything at all wrong, but just the fact that he reacted the way that he did is maybe an indication to us of where he was at emotionally. So any other comments on that? Yeah, go ahead, Joe.
I turned over to Mark 11, and it says in if I can read that, and this is about the same subject, it says, in the morning when they passed by, they saw the fig behold, the fig tree which thou cursed withered away.
Yeah, and we're going to get, that's part of next week's study, and that's fine that you brought it up. But again, Jesus never tells us exactly why he did it. He does use it to tell them, you're going to be able to do similar things. Yeah, and you're going to be able to, he says, you know, not only will you be able to curse a tree and it wither away, but you'll be able to move mountains if you, I mean, he literally is trying to, uses that as a chance to explain to them. So there was some teaching going on with this. But as far as exactly why Jesus did, I don't know. But again, I can't imagine what Jesus was going through. I can't even imagine the stress and everything else that he was under. So we will get into talking more about what Joe just brought up next week. Right now, let's go ahead and turn over to back to Mark 11. I'm going to read verses 15 through 18. And here we're going to be talking about, so Jesus goes down into Jerusalem after he's cursed this fig tree. They make the journey down into Jerusalem, and Jesus goes to the temple. And so it says, they came to Jerusalem, and Jesus went to the temple and began to drive out those who bought and sold in the temple, and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves, and he would not allow anyone to carry wares through the temple. Then he taught, saying to them, is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of thieves? And the scribes and the chief priests heard it and sought how they might destroy him, for they feared him, because all the people were astonished at his teaching. Let's turn over to Matthew 21 and read Matthew's account. Back to Matthew 21, verses 12 and 13. It says, then Jesus went into the temple of God and drove out all of those who bought and sold in the temple and overturned the tables of the money changers and the seats of those who sold doves. And he said to them, it is written, my house shall be called a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. All right, and then the final account that I'll read is Luke 19. Luke 19. Verses 45 through 48. Then he went into the temple and began to drive out those who bought and sold in it, saying to them, it is written, my house is a house of prayer, but you have made it a den of thieves. And he was teaching daily in the temple, but the chief priests and scribes and the leaders of the people sought to destroy him. And they were unable to do anything, for all the people were very attentive to hear him. So, before we get into talking about this, I want to turn back. This is the second time that Jesus has went into the temple and dealt with the people that were doing wrong there. So let's go. I want to go back real quick and read the first account, because what I want to do is compare the differences between the two. So the first time that Jesus did this is in John chapter 2. Verses 13 through 22. So this is early, very early in Jesus' ministry, and Jesus is going to go into the temple and do something similar, but there's some differences. And I think it's important that we recognize the differences. So starting in verse 13 of John chapter 2, it says, now the Passover of the Jews was at hand, and Jesus went up to Jerusalem. And he found in the temple those who sold oxen and sheep and doves and money changers doing business. And when he made a whip of cords, he drove them all out of the temple with the sheep and the oxen and poured out the changers' money and overturned the tables. And he said to those who sold doves, take these things away. Do not make my Father's house a house of merchandise. And then his disciples remembered that it was written, zeal for your house has eaten me up. So the Jews answered and said to him, what sign do you show to us since you are doing these things? And Jesus answered and said to them, destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up. And then the Jews said, it has taken 46 years to build this temple, and you will raise it up in 3 days? But he was speaking of the temple of his body. Therefore, when he had risen from the dead, his disciples remembered that he had said this to them, and they believed the scriptures and the word which Jesus had said. So, what are the differences that we see between, and I'm not talking about the details of making a whip or whatever, but what are the differences in the two times that Jesus cleanses the temple?
different men.
I believe it's two completely different occasions. One happened very early in Jesus' ministry. Mark very clearly tells us, I think it was Mark's account, that it was the day after, on the very next day after he had after the triumphal entry. So it would have been Monday of the final week. So, but if you look at what Jesus said, there's two very, it's two very distinct different things.
He refers to his body being destroyed and coming back.
Okay, that's a part of it. But what, in terms of exactly how he addresses them, there's a difference. Right. So the first time he cleanses, he is condemning them for basically turning the temple into a marketplace. You people are doing business here. And I'm going to get to some application on that in just a minute. So the first time he is condemning them, but he doesn't call them robbers. He doesn't get into any of that. He is simply saying, you are misusing the temple. The temple was not created for you to be buying and selling merchandise here. The second time, even though they're doing the same thing, Jesus gets more to them and their motivation behind everything is, you people are profiting off the people that are coming here to worship God, right? So it's very similar in a lot of ways, but it's also very distinct. The first time, Jesus is just getting on to them for the fact that they are misusing the temple or turning it into a house of merchandise. But the second time, he says, you've turned it into a den of thieves. Right? So he's a big difference in the way that he's addressing them there. And again, some of this, the exact same thing may have been going on in both occasions, but the difference may be at the time, early in his ministry, it wasn't time to incite them into complete anger. Here Jesus is at the point, that's no longer a concern, right? What's about to happen is about to happen in just a couple of days, and he's not pulling any punches here. And he's getting right down to the heart of their hearts, not just the actions that you're doing, but you're sitting here, you're profiting off of all of this stuff. You know, you're using the temple for your own personal gain. He's getting to their greed, not just the fact that you've misused the temple, but you're doing it for your own personal gain. You're getting it. So there is a clear difference if you read what Jesus talks to him there, but there's a clear difference on what Jesus is dealing with between the two times. It might be the exact same thing, but early in his ministry, he's just dealing with the fact that you guys are misusing the temple. You've made it into a house of merchandise. You've turned it into a marketplace, right? And the second time he gets into it, you know, their greed, the fact that they're profiting off of this and everything. So the first time is more teaching, right? Instead of condemning and rebuking them, the second time is not. The second time he's not just trying to teach them that, hey, don't be doing this stuff in the temple. This is not what the temple was created for. This is not what it's for. He's actually condemning them for their motivations around it, getting on to them about their greed. So in terms of some application that we can make from those two times, what do we see that we can apply to our lives today?
Put Christ first in
everything. Okay. What else? We don't see it here. We don't see it a lot that I know of in conservative churches, but in supposedly, you know, Christian churches, they've lost track of what we come together for. Chuck's talked about it. They have softball teams. They have bookstores. They have this. They have that. Are they not basically doing the same thing that is condemned here? Yeah, turning God's house into a house of merchandise. Now, we know this building is just a building, right? We know the church is the people. But in terms of the application, if we're using our service to God in ways that God hasn't authorized, in ways that just appeal to people, are we not doing the exact same thing, turning the temple into a house of merchandise? And so, again, I'm not saying that we have that problem here, but that doesn't mean that that problem can't pop up. We always need to be on guard and looking at things, because it doesn't have to be that we open a bookstore, right? It doesn't have to be that there's little ways that we can do things that, I mean, we have the other day at the Kathleen Historical Society, the dinner, and there's nothing wrong with that, us getting together and having dinner. But if our motivation behind that is, let's invite as many people as we can, let's feed as many people as we can, let's show them that we're here to, if our whole motivation around that is not just us getting together to enjoy each other's company and everything, and I'm not condemning inviting visitors, I'm saying our motivation. If my whole motivation for doing something has nothing to do with the work of the church, and it has nothing to do with just getting together, and I start misusing what God has given me in ways that I try to tie it into the church, or I try to do anything else with it, like so many, you know, denominations have done with so many different things. But what we need to be on guard for is, it doesn't have to be a big thing. We don't have to all of a sudden have a softball team for us to fall into the same trap. And so we just always need to be on guard of that we're not, you know, we need to be careful about things like, how are we authorized? How is the church authorized to get funds? Right? The members giving to, right? That's exactly what we're supposed to do. If we start looking for other ways, we're not doing anything with that, you know. Yeah, whatever it is, find ways. Oh, well, this could be, you know, we're going to put on a concert, right? We've got enough room right here on the property, and the stadium's right across the street. And if they're having an afternoon baseball game, and we were to have a big, you know, set up outside, a big deal, and invite some Christian rock group in or whatever, and that'll get people to come over here and pay attention to the fact that we exist right here, that the church is right here, and maybe it'll get some people to start. God didn't authorize that. And we'd be falling into the same trap, maybe under slightly different circumstances or whatever, of misusing what we, right? Could the elders, if they wanted to, rent this place out on a Tuesday afternoon for somebody to have a party in or whatever? Could they? They wouldn't be following God, right? They wouldn't be using, right? But you'll hear arguments, well, the building's not being used on Tuesday. Why don't we use it for, you know, that can bring, that plenty of people can make good arguments in terms of how we think physically, but we have to be careful that we stay within what God authorizes. Yeah. And Frank Jamerson, who spoke many times or preached for a long time over at Southwest many times in things, if there is no wrong, there is no right. So as soon as you do one thing and allow one thing that is outside, you've given up on right, because you're now pursuing, and it'll continue to manifest itself in more and more ways if you don't constantly get back to what's right. Go ahead, Ryan. I understand what I'd lost the word denomination in my mind. People, churches that claim to be Christians, people that claim to be Christians but aren't really following God's word. That's the point that I was trying to get to. It's not, yeah, you're either a Christian or you're not a Christian. I understand that. There's not, right, even within the people sitting here today. I have no idea.
We would do well to use the word Christian the only way the scripture do.
I understand. I understand, and we always have to be careful when we're teaching, when we're talking to other people about the way we, because things can be, the way we intend them may not be the way that they come out. So we got to be careful. But I was just trying to refer to the fact that denominations out there that claim to be Christians, right? That claim to be Christians, and in my opinion, I think people who claim to be Christians but aren't have done far more damage to the cause of Christ than people who just have say they have nothing to do with Christianity. Because when we go out there claiming to be Christians and we're not doing what God said, that tells the world that, oh, well, that's okay, Christians approve of that. And that's not the case. So, but sorry about that, Ronnie. Thank you for bringing that to my attention. That was not my... I hope everybody understands what I was trying to get across there. So, what about the second time? Or what about another application? The fact that in the temple, they're doing all this buying and selling and everything else. Take the greed out of it for a second. But what's another application that we can make to that? That Jesus goes in there and condemns them for doing what they're doing. What was the effect of what they were doing? Right, well, that's the second thing. That gets to their greed. But just in the fact that, even take the greed out of it, just in the fact that they had turned it into a marketplace, basically, what is the effect of that on God's people? Yeah. If I was a Jew during that time, and they sold everything I needed to make my sacrifices right there at the temple, right. And the whole point behind sacrifices, and I could get into this very deep, and we could go on for hours and hours talking about this, but if you examine sacrifices and the way that they were meant to be, there's a whole lot more to it than we even see. Has anybody ever been to a slaughterhouse? Animals panic when they smell blood. If you go to a slaughterhouse, the cows aren't just sitting, oh, it's my time next. I'll walk up there. You can butcher me now. When they start smelling the blood of other animals, when cows smell the blood of other cows, when sheep smell the blood of other sheep, they get nervous. They get panicky. But if you look, but if you look at the way the sacrifices were, when I went up there and I, depending on what sacrifice we're talking about, I had to first off be able to walk this animal up to the priests through all of this. So that means you had to spend time with it. We think about kids that show animals in a fair or whatever. That kind of had to be what they, you weren't just going to go out in the field and grab a sheep that the only thing you've ever done to it is poke it to get it to go to a different pasture and just gently lead that through all of this. They had to spend time with that animal. The person had to lay their hand on the animal at the time that the priest killed it for some of the sacrifice. So I don't think we get a full, all of that was meant to try to show us just how, because it wasn't just, I'm going to go out and pick out a decent looking animal. They had to start from the very beginning and find one that, oh, that's going to be a good sacrifice. I don't see a blemish on it. That's the best I have. That's what's going to be offered. And then they had to make sure that nothing happened to that little lamb for any length of time, right? Because if they didn't pay attention to it, it got caught up in a bunch of thorns and got cuts all over it. Is it unblemished anymore? No. So they had to spend a lot of time. There was a lot more that went into the sacrifices than just walking an animal up and saying, that's my sacrifice. And so when we prepare to serve God today, we should be, from the time we wake up in the morning, actually from the time we go to bed last night, we should be thinking and preparing ourselves that this is the day I'm going to worship God. And I'm not going to say that nothing can ever happen to distract you or anything else. But if you're in the habit of walking in here and at the time, oh, we're going to have the collection, oh, let me fill my check out, probably not. You probably need to go back and examine, are you really doing what God wants us to do? Are we really putting the time and the effort into thinking about what I'm going to give God? We are supposed to be prepared to come in here to worship God, not just show up and worship Him. And that's part of the effect that what they were doing in the temple had, right? Is that people could just show up. And there was no forethought about what they had to do and everything else. So that's an application that we need to look at too, is just how much time do we actually prepare, time spent preparing ourselves to worship God? Are we really prepared to worship God when we walk through that door, you know, or are we not? Or is it, I'm just going to walk in and Chuck will get me in the mood, right? All right, we're done.
That was your job in Bible.
No, I did my job.